is the podcast for Wednesday, January 26, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. More on Berkeley. So, a brief announcement. The test was originally slated to close today, but has been extended until Monday. So you have until Monday, 7 o'clock, to take the exam. Of course, you're free to take it before then. Anytime the lab is open, lab has Saturday hours. Don't forget they close early on Friday. They close at 5 o'clock on Friday, which means you need to get there by 4 o'clock. Even though it might not take you the entire hour, the lab personnel don't like to have to sit there after hours while they're not being paid, or to stand over you telling you to hurry up and finish your exam so they can leave. So they'd like you to get there before an hour before closing to take any exam. Okay, I found the passage I was looking for last time in Berkeley. So I'm going to go over a couple of particulars of Berkeley's argument. Again, Berkeley is an idealist. I don't know if I wrote that up on the board last time. Idealism says that only the mental exists. I was going to make a joke about doing a slideshow, and I see there's like a slide carousel. Maybe we could have a film strip. I bet nobody here even knows what a film strip is. I can run off some copy of the Ditto Master. And the blue, yellow, blue.
I used to have to run the projector.
Okay, yeah. The film strip, like when I was in elementary school, instead of having like movies that were expensive, they had this film strip. It was like a strip of film, and it was kind of like the poor man's slideshow. So there'd be like a little knob you'd turn, and it would change the next frame. You know, it would just be like still pictures, kind of like a high-tech Viewmaster projected on the screen with like a bad quality audio track to go with it. And each time you're supposed to like twist the thing to show the next strip on the film, it would go beep. So I don't know why. There's a few older instructors here that are still using the overheads. All right, so get myself into trouble. I think I showed a VHS movie in my other class the other day, which is similarly old technology. I just can't find a new copy of it. So we're talking about Berkeley, and Berkeley is an idealist. Only the mental exists. And for Berkeley, it's minds which are mental substances, and then there are ideas, which are mental qualities. And in the dialogue, you see that the Hylas, representing Locke's view, accuses Philonous of denying the existence of real things. So again, Hylas is Locke. Locke says, he gives a sort of common sense view, that there are the perceived qualities of objects, and then there are the objects themselves. The objects are what actually exists, what we call the material world, which we are acquainted with through our senses. Our senses put us in touch with the real world, indirectly. Again, representationalism. And so, representationalism. Now, let's see, and then Philonous is Berkeley, and again, he's an idealist, and he says essentially, what you see is what you get. And so, when Hylas says, you deny the existence of real things you are a skeptic. You know, a crazy skeptic. What's Barclay's reply? What does he say when he's accused of that? Do you remember? What's his general response to you, Barclay? You're a crazy skeptic, or Philonis, you know, standing in for Barclay. Philonis, you have this extravagant opinion that the real world doesn't exist. What could be more skeptical than that? That's a crazy view. Yeah.
Doesn't he say that he like begins thinking like a skeptic, but then there's like a different kind of end that he's going for?
That sounds like Descartes. So Descartes has a skeptical method, but he's trying to prove the existence of the real world. Barclay doesn't believe in the existence of the material world at all.
Doesn't he say something like, "You're the crazy one for believing in matter"?
Yeah, he says, my view is the common sense view. I say, when I'm looking at the table, I'm looking at the table. What am I looking at? I'm looking at a sensible object. I'm directly aware of its shape, its texture, its color, its heaviness if I pick it up. That's what a material object is. And so, Barclay says, first of all, Philonis says a couple of things. The first thing he says is that calling me a skeptic begs the question. And essentially, am I a skeptic? For doubting the philosophers' unproven theory of matter or material substance.
So what would Barclay say if he got stabbed or like hit by a car?
Ouch.
Like, would he acknowledge that, hey, a physical knife just hurt me, or a car just hit me? Or would he just be like, oh, another idea in my head?
Well, that's a good question. Somebody else want to tackle that? Material substance or substratum. So all of these are different ways in the dialogue of talking about the same thing, substratum. Again, this is Locke's theory of substance, right? Something I know not what, which supports qualities. We have this idea that there is the sensations or perceptions, and then there's the real world. And that our sensations are somehow coming from the real world, or that beneath our sensations are material objects, which are the cause of those sensations. And this is parlayed out as common sense. Before we get to the would Barclay, you know, duck if you threw a rock at him or something, I want to finish this point. But we'll get right to that then. So what's Barclay's response to this when he's accused of being a skeptic and he says, well, he says, am I the skeptic? Because I don't believe in your cockamamie philosophical theory about material substratum. But the second response is, my view is common sense. And I'm a direct realist. I believe that what you see is what you get. I'm the common sense person here. I say that when I hear a sound, I move it this way. My view are sounds are something you hear. Locke says, strictly speaking, you can never hear a sound. What you hear are vibrations in the air or something, right? Because sound, for Barclay, is something you hear. Barclay says, a color is something you see. Locke wants to say it's you know, it's a light wave or something, and or it's light waves bouncing off of this, you know, external object made of atoms or something which you can't see either. How is that empirical? And Berkeley says this whole idea of the material world is not consistent with empiricism. Colors are something you see. And so this one of the I think best questions that Philonis has for Hylas when they're talking about material substance. Hylas is again scratching his head, wondering where he's gone wrong in his argument. And then he says, material substratum, call you it. By which of your senses came you to be acquainted by that being? And Hylas is like, well, all of them. Like, well, really? So tell me, can you see substance? And then Hylas has to say, well, you really can't see substance. What you see is you see like colors and shapes, and then you feel textures, and then you make the inference that there's a real world beyond those sensations, which are the cause of that. And then Berkeley says, well, what justifies that inference? And Locke says, it's kind of obvious, you know, it's the real world, and it's different from our sensations. Now let's go to the would Berkeley dodge a runaway coach, or would he, you know, if you stab Berkeley, would he say, oh, it's just an idea? Would he be like a Christian Science practitioner that when they get cancer, they say, oh, the material world is an illusion, I'll have people pray for me and I'll try to believe really strongly I don't have cancer, and then I won't have cancer? Or what would he do? Is Berkeley going to act differently than anybody else with his view that real things, and this is what Berkeley says, real things are just collections of qualities. Real things are collections of qualities which are, what would you call this? Well, and they're also the same as Locke's complex ideas. Because for Berkeley, I'm going to keep on asking more questions instead of letting you answer the previous question. Let me just make one other point in that for Berkeley, ask this question. Is there a difference in Berkeley between a quality and an idea? Or what's the distinction between a quality and an idea if you have a view like Hylas's or like Locke's? What's the difference between a quality and an idea? What sorts of entities have qualities?
Material objects,
right? So you have material objects, things, substances. Those are all different ways of talking about the material world. So we have the cup, right? The cup. And it has qualities. This one, it's purple is probably the most noticeable shape or noticeable quality. It's conical or something, and you know it's got a certain shape. It's large, so it's got a certain size, and you know it makes certain sounds when you touch it. It's smooth when you rub your hands over it. It's got a smooth texture. So these are all qualities of the cup. The cup is the thing or the object, and the qualities are the ways in which it exists. The cup exists in a purple way, you might say. The cup exists in a conical way. So these are all things which qualify the ways in which this material object exists. They describe its nature. And so when Berkeley is talking about a quality, though, right, so this is the thing and the qualities. Now, what's the difference between a thing and a quality in an idea? say the idea of the cup.
It's just like the collection of qualities.
Yeah. So, an idea is different from a quality. What relationship do ideas have to qualities? This will be on the exam, by the way.
Like how you perceive them.
Yeah, that's kind of getting at somebody else. What's the difference between what's the relationship between idea and quality? Yeah.
Ideas come from qualities. Distractions.
Good, almost got it. So ideas come from qualities. They're caused by qualities. And they're an abstraction. What does an abstraction do? How is it abstract?
Puts together a thought from information that you received.
Yeah. What do ideas do for qualities? They represent them. Like your supposed political representative, right? They stand in for you and cast votes in your name, usually the opposite of what you would want them to do. So ideas represent qualities. They stand in for qualities. The qualities are out there in the world. The ideas are there in your mind. When I'm aware of this purple cup, is my mind purple? If when I'm thinking about purple, is my mind purple? No, right? My mind doesn't become purple. So what happens is there's a purple object out there, and my mind creates a concept of a purple object in my mind. And actually, purple is probably not a good example because, again, that's a secondary quality. And Locke has to sort of straddle the fence on this. Secondary qualities are kind of, they almost straddle the concept of quality and idea, because they're not really out there in the world, but they're not just in your mind. They're kind of in both places at once. And Philonous actually makes a lot of hay of that. He says, well, when you're looking at an object, is it the same place as the object itself, or is it in your mind? And Hylas says, well, it's out there in the world. And then he says, well, wait a minute, not really. It's kind of both places. And Barclay says, look, when I'm looking at, like, the purple cup is... the shape is the same place as the color, right? Because you can't see shape without color, and you can't see color without shape. You've got to have some color to pick out an object from the background. So shape and color are either out there in the world, or they're both in your mind, which is what Barclay wants to you to believe. So you have an object, the cup, and it's got qualities of various sorts. You have the idea of the cup, which is, according to Locke, a complex idea. And it's made up of simple ideas, like purple is a simple idea. Purple is a simple idea, which represents... So purple is a simple idea, which represents the quality of purple, or purpleness. Some of these, it's kind of hard to distinguish between a quality and idea, because we call them by the same name. We say you have the idea of purpleness and the quality of purpleness. We use the same word for it. But there is a difference between the quality, which is out there in the world, and the idea, which is in your mind. Or the shape, which is probably a better example. So then you have this shape of the quality of being conical, having a cone-like shape. There's probably some name for a cone that isn't uniform, is a convex cone or something like that. Whatever the shape of this cup is, we could say generally it's got a cup-like shape because it's got like an inside to it, and it's got a handle and a lid and so on. So it's got a certain shape. We have the idea of the shape, which again is a simple idea. It's a primary quality. Purpleness, secondary quality. Green conical is shape, so it's a primary quality. We have the idea that represents the quality in our mind, a simple idea. All qualities are represented by simple ideas. They combine to form a complex idea. But there's a difference between the real cup and our idea of the cup, or our perception of the cup. So it's Locke's view. Now what about Barclay's view? Is there a difference between quality and an idea?
He combines them together, doesn't he?
Yeah, they're the same thing, right? there's no purpleness out there in the world. There's no cup there out there in the world. It's all ideas. So a real thing is just a collection of qualities. Or, to put it another way, a real thing is a complex idea made up of simple ideas. And it's all in your mind. And those ideas come not from an external world of matter, which is unprovable, but they come from God. And you might say, well, God's unprovable. Berkeley's got some things to say about how you know there's a God. But we'll get to that later. So now, coming back to the question, if there's a runaway coach and Barclay's in the middle of the street and he looks up with surprise and alarm and sees the coach racing towards him, he's going to be trampled by the horses and then run over by the wheels. Does he dodge out of the way, or does he say, well, that coach is not made of material substance, therefore there's no reason for me to be surprised and alarmed? He just stand there and get run over. What would he do?
You get out of the way.
Yeah, get out of the way. Suppose suppose Barclay hasn't had breakfast and he's got done with a rather exhausting lecture trying to explain the principles of idealism to his skeptical students. What does he do? Does he think, well, my body isn't really nourishment because there isn't a such thing as material substance? Or does he go get a bite to eat? Another question is why? Why does he get something to eat?
He has to.
Still has a need.
Well, what is it? If there's no material substance, how does he have a need? Well, yeah, I think the idea is that Barclay gets hungry and Barclay feels pain when he's run over by a coach. But what is a coach? A coach is just a collection of certain ideas, right? Ideas of shape and color and size. There's a discussion in the dialogue about pain. Idealists believe in pain too. They believe that pain, is bad and you want to avoid it. And so, if you throw a rock at Barclay, of course he's going to duck because he doesn't want an idea of pain, right? He's going to have an idea of pain, an idea of a lump on his forehead, an idea of falling to the ground. But it's all ideas. You don't really have to believe in material substance to understand that when someone throws a rock at you, it hurts. But then what is a rock? A rock is just a certain combination of hardness and solidity and weight and so on.
So when he sees a rock coming at him, he's like dodging an idea. Is that what it is?
Yeah, well, like your body's an idea too, right? So I mean, you think about this as being like a big virtual reality simulation, or like being in a dream. If someone throws a rock at you in the dream, it probably hurts.
But then these ideas become objective, don't they? I mean, if you pick up a rock and throw it at him, and he dodges because he knows he's gonna experience an idea of pain, and then you pick up that same rock and you throw it again at him, he's gonna dodge it again. So, I mean, the idea that it's going to be painful every single time from that same object would mean that that object has to be independent of his mind, right?
Yeah, this is the part that's kind of difficult. Are ideas external to your mind, or are they internal to your mind? And Barclay has this statement that he uses, to be is to be perceived. To be is to be perceived, which means to exist means to exist in some mind. So there's that poem by Ronald Knox, and the end of which goes, and that's why the tree continues to be since observed by yours faithfully, God. So the tree out in the quad, we don't have any trees in our quad, we just have grass. But imagine if there was a tree in our quad. If there's nobody around to perceive the tree, Barclay says God still perceives the tree, so the tree exists. This is why you have a stable world, because God's perceiving all the ideas that we're perceiving. So that if you this way, if is he assuming an external world of ideas instead of matter? Barclay talks that way sometimes, but I think that if you really look at his overall theory, it's just this this view that we're each of us are being fed ideas moment to moment by God, depending on what we decide to do. So you have a will, and you can decide to jump out of the coach's way or not. And then depending on what you do, God's going to send you different ideas. And that's what we call the laws of nature. In that, when now the people that believe in the material world, they say, well, God created this material world, which can't be seen, it can't be touched, it can't be felt. It's hiding beneath all these perceptions that we're directly aware of. There's no way of proving it exists. And along with this material world, God built into it what we call the laws of nature and cause and effect, such that if one thing happens in the material world, another thing has to happen. Barclay says he's just cutting out the middleman, and the laws of nature apply as a way of describing how God decides to give you certain sensations as a result of certain actions you take.
Does he believe in free will still?
Yeah.
He kind of guides us or plants seeds, but we have the choice to water them or neglect them?
Yeah, you have a mind, and your mind can decide to do certain things. When I raise my arm, it's like, do I think I'm going to raise, my muscles in my arm will move, so those muscles are made of atoms, and those atoms will reach different configuration when my arm goes up. No, I just raise my arm. Where is my arm? Well, you can say it's made of muscle, fiber, and skin, and so on. But what are those? Those are just descriptions of sensory properties, right? So all of our descriptions of the material world, they break down to sensory properties. But what the philosophers do is they try to go beyond that, and they say, well, we have these sensory properties, but our sensations aren't really showing us the real world. The real world is made of strings vibrating in 11-dimensional hyperspace. Or at the time of Barclay, they're made of these little corpuscles, as Locke calls them, or atoms, which are in different configurations and create those different sensory properties. But that the real world is unknowable and undetectable, and we just sort of have to guess at what it's really like based on our sensations. And Barclay says, how do you even know such a world exists? Why not just say the world of the senses is the real world? That's common sense. This other is a bunch of philosophers trying to tear down people's faith in God and cook up this theory which has no proof to it. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just asking another question.
Okay.
Barclay. So what happens if, let's say he was shot in the back of the head and killed instantly and he didn't experience any of it? He doesn't experience the idea of pain or death or anything because it happens instantly. So what would he say? Would he say that that's an idea that he just didn't understand, or was it a material object destroying another material object?
Well, it's an interesting question in that, in Barclay's own mind, it would be he'd have an experience of all of other experiences abruptly stopping. But other people would see Barclay be shot in the head and see him fall down. So then the question is, what's happening there? Is it that God is sort of feeding people different ideas which all kind of sync up? Or is that the ideas are out there in the world and you have all these different minds that are perceiving the same idea? So the question, the board's already full here, is do we perceive the same idea, or are we getting tailor-made different ideas, each of us, by God? And then I think Barclay is hard to see what his view is. Is it there's just one, each person gets their individually tailored ideas from moment to moment, and they just sort of happen to sync up in a certain way? Like, are we all looking at the same chair, or are each of us getting a different view of the chair? Because if you think about our sensations, they're all different, right? So if I'm looking at the chair, I might see, I might see this. But if you're looking at the chair from the side of the room, you might, see something like this. And of course, people at the back of the room, they're going to see this, right? They're going to see something smaller. But were they to walk in the front of the room, maybe they'd see this. So our perceptions are of what we think of as the same object are all different. So the question is, if these are just, ideas, is it that we have different minds, kind of out there that are sort of perceiving different ideas?
Yes,
or are we all looking at the same idea and getting different sensations?
Different.
Are we looking at the same idea from different perspectives? Yeah.
Like when people are asked to go into a room and look at it quickly and then turn away and draw what they have remembered, everyone's going to have a different drawing, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of people will have a different drawing. No, they're not all going to be the same, and that has to do with perception, right?
It might have to do with memory, though.
Yeah.
So that might be like a different problem. That's a problem for perception, even if you believe there's a material world. But people, I mean, right now, like, okay. Copier. What shape is this?
Round
circle.
What shape is
flat?
This. Mm-hmm. It's just like a line, right? But if I do this, I'm seeing round while you're seeing like just like a flat shape. Or you might see, you know, something that's sort of like an oval or something if I tilt it this way. So are we perceiving the same lid, the same object, the same idea? Or are we perceiving the different idea, different ideas each individually? So are we perceiving the same idea in a different way, or do we each have different ideas?
Because we've seen those before, and we might only see a certain angle of it. Our mind kind of puts things together to say, well, I only see this much of it, but I know and hold that it's a lid. So you kind of almost put the things together that you can't see.
Now you're a rationalist.
So,
yeah, well, I mean, that seems like it's going beyond the senses. To think that you have a material object that's objective and that you see that the same object perceived from different vantage points is the same material substance, that's going beyond what your senses tell you. What your senses tell you, here's one shape and here's another shape. And I suppose you think about them as being related in certain ways. But your senses don't tell you this is like an external object.
Wouldn't it be kind of like different ideas making up, or different qualities making up the same idea?
Yeah, so maybe like a whole bunch of different qualities, all the possible, and this is actually the way, jumps ahead to this idea of phenomenalism. You do have philosophers that say that Berkeley is right about what words mean, but he's wrong about what exists. So some modern philosophers, like in the 20th century, have said Berkeley hit on something really profound about what words in ordinary language mean. And this is this term called phenomenalism. Phenomenalism is a theory about language. It's about what words mean. And it says that, for example, water, it means clear, colorless liquid, you know, which quenches thirst, doesn't poison you, yada yada. You just sort of go down a long, long list, not, you know, H2O or something, which is the kind of material language, the language of chemistry and science. And so when someone, like you could have someone who's a member of an Aboriginal tribe that doesn't understand the chemical makeup of water. And when he uses the word water in his language, and the translator says, you know, he's offering you a cup of water, he doesn't know that it's H2O. So what he means is clear, colorless liquid that quenches thirst and can be used for X, Y, and Z, and you sort of go down the line of all the description, sensory properties of water. That what an object is, the word which describes what an object is, describes all of its actual and possible sensory properties. And that's what words mean. So although what water is it's two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen in a covalent bond, what the word water means is clear, colorless liquid that quenches thirst. It's cashed out in terms of its sensory properties. So the meaning of words, are their sensory properties, sensory qualities. are the sensory qualities of the beings they denote. Sensory qualities. And you might put actual and possible. So you can kind of imagine different circumstances where you might get different sensory qualities from water. So the idea is that sometimes it's described as objects are permanent possibilities of sensation. So if you think about an object as a permanent possibility of sensation, you could say, well, okay, metaphysically speaking, this cup really exists. But when I'm talking about what I mean the cup, I mean that were I to take this cup and were I to open it and fill it with liquid, the liquid would stay inside it. And, were I to tap on it, it would make a certain sound. And were I to, it's made of plastic, were I to put it under extreme heat, it would melt and so on. As opposed to, like, maybe ceramic, which wouldn't melt. So a lot of philosophers think that what Berkeley's view, as far as the view about the meaning of words in ordinary language, is a good view, but his idealist view they still think is kooky. Questions about phenomenalism? This will be one of those terms that you need to know for the exam. So this is different from idealism. Idealism is a metaphysical theory. It's about reality. It's about what exists. As opposed to phenomenalism, which is a theory about language and what words mean. So you can be a phenomenalist and not be an idealist. And a lot of the philosophers have said that Berkeley's arguments sort of strike a chord and are hard to refute because of the way we use language. What do you hear? You hear sounds. What is a sound? A sound is that which you hear. What do you see? You see colors and shapes, right? What are colors and shapes? They're visual sensations. You don't think about them as being like made of atoms, or you don't think about them as being light waves reflecting off the an object and so on. Yeah.
That to be is to be perceived. Is that Locke?
No, that's Berkeley.
Berkeley.
That's Berkeley. To be is to be perceived. When you say X exists, you mean X is an idea in some mind. And remember, only minds have independent existence. Ideas are sort of put into the mind by God and they come and go. The ideas are the stable things. Ideas are things. Minds are things. Ideas are qualities. The qualities, like in this cup, if I painted this cup orange, then it would no longer be purple. The qualities of this cup can change, it can still be the same cup. A mind can get different ideas and still be the same mind. But if an idea, idea can't change to one. It's from one idea to another. The ideas sort of come and go in and out of your mind. But your mind is a spiritual substance which endures through time. Ideas sort of come and go. Yeah.
So in reference to be is to be perceived. Hypothetical situation, if you took like a blind person and you gave them a cube and they felt it and you told them it was a cube,
mm-hmm.
And then you set the cube on the table with other geometric shapes and then he was made to see, would he be able to recognize the cube from other geometric shapes even if he can't perceive them? So like, if he can't perceive them, does it not exist? Does the cube not exist to him? Or
yeah, so you're thinking about like some people, like if you restore the optics of their perception, if their brain hasn't developed to register the shape, then they don't. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah, basically like for Berkeley, if you can't perceive it, then it doesn't exist.
Well, it doesn't exist if it isn't being perceived by some mind.
No.
So,
once it's perceived,
so if somebody else is there in the room, then the idea exists because it's being perceived by that
okay,
person.
Okay, so he's basically ultimately saying God perceives everything, so everything that exists is perceived by God, so that's why we know it exists?
Yeah, that's what, like, represent. That's why, and this kind of makes it look like the ideas are kind of out there, that God still perceives the books in the study even when I'm not looking at them. So when I like leave my office, does my office still exist? Well, Barclay would say yes. Would say yes because God still perceives my study,
okay.
and you know, the books in it. So this is why when you close your eyes, the world doesn't suddenly disappear. Because even though you might not be perceiving, like say this cup, I might be perceiving it. Or even if no one's in the room, if we all leave and turn out the lights, God's still perceiving the cup. So the cup still exists. So therefore, you know, Barclay again says, well, this is, you know, common sense. You try to argue against him by saying, well, that's crazy. That means that if nobody's looking at the cup, then the cup doesn't exist. And he says, well, God's still looking at the cup. So,
but then he has like a huge qualifier of God. Like if God doesn't exist, then does the cup still exist if he's not there to see it?
Then the cup wouldn't exist. But so then how does he know God exists? Well, Barclay makes the following argument. He says, you have a notion of God, of the divine will. So sometimes you do things and you're not able to do them. Like you try to do, 50 push-ups and you can only do 48 push-ups. Why can't you do 50 push-ups if your will is to do 50? Well, Barclay says it's because there's another will which is sometimes contrary to your own, which keeps you from doing what you want to do. That's God. When you have a toothache and you want it to go away, it doesn't go away. That's God sending you the idea of the toothache. And things that people would normally attribute to the material world, people who are locked into this belief in material substance, Barclay just attributes to God. God is responsible for what we call the forces of nature. God's that which is behind all your perceptions.
So he's responsible for pain and suffering?
Sure.
So then God
and goodness and happiness too.
No, but if that's the case, then God isn't benevolent? Or his idea of God wouldn't be benevolent since...
Well, what's the difference between that and God creating a world full of pain and suffering? It still seems like he's responsible. So whether God directly gives you the toothache or gives you the shoddily built teeth which are liable to bacterial contamination and rotting and falling out of your mouth, it seems like the same thing. That he's equally... He'd be equal... That the one's not necessarily... isn't really worse than the other. Or that ultimately he's responsible in either case. So the idea, if you have like, if you have a sensation here, material world. So like, take you're looking at the, you have a perception of a tree. So. Here's your mind. So now the Locke would say you've got like an eye that's hooked up to your brain, which is hooked up to your mind, and you're seeing a real tree out there in the material world. And somehow this creates the idea of the tree in your mind. Whereas Barclay will just say that God is sending you the idea of the tree into your mind. And it happens directly. And so if you say, well, you know, of course there's a real world, and looking at the tree right now, that's part of the real world, Barclay will just say, well, what do you mean by real world? You mean God created the real world and that you're aware of it indirectly through your sensations, which aren't the real world, but somehow represent the real world in your mind. And he'll say, that's kind of a complicated theory. My theory is just that God just gives you the sensations, which is common sense, right? When you're looking at the tree, you're looking at the tree. Direct realism. Yeah.
Isn't that kind of like the brain in the bath? And like considering an alien, you got your brain and an alien sitting here pumping all these senses and these like illusions, like kind of like the arch deceiver.
Yeah, it's like the arch deceiver, except for he's not really deceptive, because it's not really a deception unless there really is a real world and you're being fed a bunch of fake sensations. Barclay's idea is that the only reason you believe in material substance is you listen to all these damned atheists try to convince you that there's a real world apart from God's creative acts. or that God created this material world and kind of let it go and went on vacation and doesn't pay any attention to it. So there's no, and so he says there's no proof for the material world, and so but he thinks you're directly conscious of these sensations. They have to come from somewhere. And he says, well, of course, who's the creator of everything? Well, God. So it's kind of a no-brainer. Other thoughts? Arguments against Barclay.
Couldn't like the material world like be God in a sense, like God that holds like everything together, you know, he's like the connections between everything that keep the sustainability of the universe?
Yeah, I mean, you can think about there's a material world that God sort of keeps in existence, or God is the material world. It's hard for me to make sense of that, like, you know, God is the rock. Does that mean atheists believe in God? If I'm an atheist and I believe in the material world, does that mean I'm an atheist because God is a material world? It seems kind of funny. Like the claim that God is everything or that God is a material world, I find hard to make sense out of. Because classically speaking, I mean, the Western tradition at least, the idea is God's a spiritual being that created the world. Now the East thinks about the world as being some sort of manifestation of God. But they also think the material world is kind of an illusion, and that that God is sort of taking a different shape or form as a material world, and that the world is essentially spiritual in nature, which is more along the lines, I think, of Barclay's view. So then the question is, do people that believe in this kind of Eastern spirituality, do they really believe in the material world? Well, I mean, if you look at classical Hinduism and later Buddhism, you might say not really. So let's look at a couple of particular arguments from Barclay. Click on 102. Okay. Okay, near about two-thirds of the way down, they're arguing about color. Let's see. So Hyla says, pardon me, the case of colors are very different. Can anything be plainer than that we see them on the objects? And Philonous says, the objects you speak are, I suppose, corporeal substances existing without the mind, they are. So Locke's saying there's real objects out there in the world, or Hylas, who's the representative of Locke, says there's real objects out in the world, and they have color. And Philonous says, and have true and real colors inherent in them? And then Hylas says, each visible object hath color which we see in it. And then Philonous says, how? Is there anything visible but what we perceive in sight? And Hylas agrees. And then he says, Philonous says, have patience, good Hylas, and tell me once more, is there anything immediately perceived by the senses, that means directly, except sensible qualities, sight, sounds, you know, colors, shapes, so on? I know you assert there was not, but I would now be informed whether you still persist in the same opinion. I do. Pray, is your corporeal substance, again, this is talking about matter, either a sensible quality, or is it made up of sensible qualities? In other words, is it one particular sensation like a color or a shape, or is it a combination of colors and shapes and smells and tastes and so on? And then Hyla says, what a question, whoever thought it was? And then Philonous replies, my reason for asking is because in saying each visible object hath that color which we see in it, you make visible objects to be corporeal substances, which implies either that corporeal substances are sensible qualities, or else there is something besides sensible qualities perceived by sight. And of course, neither of those will work. Let's see. And then they get to this bit about the tulip. Let's see. Let's skip over that. 106, I think. Let me see the bit about the tulip. No, I lost it again. they're looking at the colors of this flower. 102, 103.
I think it's 112.
Oh, is it 112? Oh, there we go. Thanks. There's something else.
The bottom of the page.
Yeah. I wonder if I wanted to get something else here. Yeah, it's more of the same. Let's see when I pick this up. They're talking about a particular object. So Hyla says, one great oversight I take to be this, that I did not sufficiently distinguish the object from the sensation. Again, this is, you know, common, what we think about as being common sense. You have the object, which is part of the material world, which is out there, and then we have the sensation, which is in our mind. So Hyla says, okay, let's start over again. Okay, you got the object, the thing, the material substance, and then you have the sensation, which is caused by the object. Now, though this latter may not exist without the mind, in other words, sensations do not exist without someone sensing. A sensation is that which is sensed by a mind. So he and Barclay agree with that. So now, sensations may not exist without a mind, or can't exist without a mind, yet it is not. It will not thence follow the former can. So in other words, sensations can exist without a mind sensing them, but an object can exist, right? There's material objects, and if I have a book in my study, no one's sensing it, but it still exists. What object do you mean? The object of the senses? The same. Is it then immediately or directly perceived? Right. Okay, big mistake on Hyla's part. Make me to understand the difference between what is immediately, directly, perceived and a sensation. So what's the difference between what you see, what you perceive directly, and a sensation? And then Hyla says, the sensation I take to be an act of the mind perceiving, besides which there is something perceived, this I call the object. For example, there is red and yellow on that tulip, but then the act of perceiving those colors is in me only and not in the tulip. And this is, you know, Locke's qualification that, well, color is kind of different, that's a secondary quality, it's not really the tulip part, it's sort of partly in my mind. And then Polona says, what tulip do you speak of? Is it that which you see? The same. And what do you see besides color, figure, and extension? Nothing. Okay, well, where's this, you know, real tulip you're talking about? Beyond the color and the shape and the size and so on. What would you say then is that red and yellow are coexistent with extension? Is it not? And coexistent just means existing, you know, in the same space as with the color. And then Hyla says, that is not all. I would say that they have a real existence without the mind in some unthinking substance. Again, this is the idea Locke has, is that the tulip exists there out there in the material world without being perceived. It's just that people can perceive it, but its existence does not depend upon our sensations. And then Filona says that the colors are really in the tulip, which I see is manifest. It's obvious that the colors are in the tulip. Neither can it be denied that the tulip may exist independent of your mind or mine, but that any immediate object of the senses should exist in an unthinking substance exterior to all minds is an evident contradiction. And so, again, his idea is that the tulip still exists in God's mind, even if it doesn't exist in any of our minds. And then Filona says, I see you have no mind to be pressed in this way. So to return to your distinction between sensation and object. And they talk more about whether a perception can exist in any unthinking thing. And so Filona says, let's see. Let's see. Talk about an act of will. fixation. Okay, so let's go to 115 here. So Hylas says, I acknowledge, Philonous, that upon a fair observation of what passes in my mind, I can discover nothing else but that I am a thinking being, affected with various sensations, neither of which it is possible to conceive how a sensation should exist in an unperceiving substance. But then, on the other hand, when I look at on sensible things with a different view, considering them as so many modes and qualities, I find it necessary to suppose a material substratum, without which they cannot be conceived to exist. So what does he mean by this? Well, he says, when you think about what you're directly aware of, you say, well, I'm directly aware of colors and shapes and sizes and smells and tastes. And then I think, okay, well, I have all these sensations, and that's really all I can know. I'm a, you know, go back to Descartes. I'm a thinking thing. What am I aware of? Sensations, thoughts. Where do they come from? Well, he says, when you start thinking about, well, where do these come from, and what do they exist in, you have this vague notion that there's something out there that's causing those sensations. And this is what he says, you have to suppose a material substratum without which they cannot be conceived to exist. And then, and again, that's a rationalist intuition. Right? When Locke says, you just can't imagine, it doesn't make sense how you can have sensations without objects in which are the causes of the sensations, or to have qualities which exist without existing in a certain object, that's crazy. You can't conceive of it. Well, when you say I'm not going to believe in it because you can't conceive of it, that's a rationalist argument, right? It's not an empirical argument based on the senses. It's based on what makes sense, what you can conceive of, what seems logical, and that's, you know, thinking like Descartes. And Berkeley's saying, if you want to be a real empiricist, you got to stick to your senses. So again, he says, material substratum, call you it? Pray, by which of your senses came you acquainted with that being? And Hylas has to admit, well, none. It is not itself sensible, its modes and qualities only being perceived by the senses. So he had this sort of indirect thing. And then he says, I presume then it was by reflection and reason you obtained the idea of it. And then Hylas admits, well, I don't really have a clear idea of it at all. It's sort of this vague notion. I do not pretend to have any proper idea of it. However, I conclude it exists because qualities cannot be conceived to exist without a support. And then you get this other argument about qualities must support, that qualities must be supported by a material substance. And so, let's see, where can I draw here?
How does Berkeley tackle the idea of God? Is that just an idea?
Well, God is what's responsible for your sensations. So how do you get your sensations? Well, God's sending you the sensations.
So is God material? I mean, is... Or
nope.
Spiritual.
God's sensations are spiritual, too. There's only minds and ideas. So... if I stub my toe, what gives me the feeling of solidity followed by a feeling of pain? That's God sending ideas to me moment for moment. God created the world. But the world is a world of ideas. That's the only world there is. The world of matter is a concoction of philosophers who want to have a world which can exist without God.
So if we're interconnected like that, are we interdependent then? Like, we couldn't really exist without this God.
Yeah, God's kind of like, think about, like, if I go up to someone and punch them in the jaw, right? Then it's kind of weird in that I do something which causes someone else to experience something. But the real story is that I have a volition of punching, and then God sends the other guy a sensation of jaw hitting. So God's a middleman. But with the material world, it's the same way, right? I have the volition of punching, and then my material fist follows a certain trajectory and hits the person in their material jaw, giving them a sensation of pain in their mind. So it's there's still a middleman. It's just that anytime we would say, well, that's the material world, that's the real world. Berkeley will say it's just God.
Yeah, it's just different names for it. The same thing, just different names or theories.
Yeah. And he would say, and Barclay would say, well, everybody knows, you know, there's a God, but this material world is you know, an open question. What proof is there of it? I suppose, you know, Hume will come along and say, well, this, there's no more reason to believe in God than there is a material world, so we really can't say where our sensations are coming from. And so Hume borrows all of Barclay's arguments and then says, and God's got to go too. So we're with this, left with this big question mark of where our sensations come from. Qualities must be supported by substance.
Qualities or ideas?
Qualities. So, according to Hylas, substance is that which supports qualities. And so, Philona says, okay, so you have the qualities up here, and you have the substance underneath it. And what support is when you have one thing underneath another, holding it up. Is that what you mean? Well, you know, then Hylas agrees, foolishly. And then they go through this argument and says, well, what does it mean to for one thing to support another? It means for it to be spread out. So what is so for one thing, or one thing supporting another, means for the first to be spread out into the second. To support means to be spread out underneath. Seems to make sense, right? So the substance is going to spread out underneath. But to be spread out is a quality. What's it the quality of? You may know what being spread out is a quality of?
Substance.
It's a quality of substance, but it's called extension. Extension is basically having a certain size. So extension is a fancy way of saying size, as distinct from shape. So being extended in space just means having a certain shape, and then shape qualifies what that shape is. But then extension is a quality. Extension, or having some size, is a quality. Which itself must be supported by another substance. Ad infinitum.
Bunch of turtles.
Right? This is the idea of an infinite regress. You have a substance, a quality, the quality spread out, quality, and then you have the quality of size, that's spread out, so it has to be supported by substance. That substance being supported by quality, the quality is going to have size because it's spread out, extension, so if you have another substance underneath this, and you just keep on going forever. And this is the idea, is that it's an absurdity. So if you have an infinite regress, that's a sign that something's gone wrong with your theory. Infinite regress. So this is an attempt to show that the notion of material substance as that which supports qualities is incoherent, because it leads to an infinite regress. That if substance supports qualities, it's spread out under the qualities. If it's spread out under the qualities, it has extension. That extension is a quality which requires support for the substance. That second substance is spread out underneath that quality. It's got the quality of extension because it's spread out. You just keep on going forever. And so it doesn't make any sense.
So is this just language, a misuse of language, or is this really a fallacy?
That's a good question. So is this a good argument against the notion of substance? Like, what would you say if you were Hylas and you weren't being written by Berkeley, right? Remember, Berkeley is the one who's writing these arguments and writing the part of Hylas. He like, looks like a dunce, you know, in his responses.
You'd have to say a substance is definitive, like that it, there's nothing less than it. It's all that is below qualities. You'd have to give like an ultimatum type thing, like substances, all that is below the qualities.
So a substance is below qualities instead of above. It's below qualities. Well, if the qualities are up here, the substance is down there. It's below qualities. It seems like you get the same problem. Now, if I were Hylas, I might say, what, that this is a metaphorical relationship. That when I'm saying substance supports qualities, do I really mean that you have the qualities up here and the substance down here holding you up like a, you know, like some pillars hold up a pier? No, I'm giving a word picture. I'm saying, well, kind of, you know, it sort of holds it together. But then the problem is explaining what exactly this relationship is in concrete terms is difficult to do. And Locke even admits this, right? When he says that we're kind of like children when we talk about substance. We think, okay, well, there's the sensations, and then there's like the stuff that's causing the sensation. But you can't really describe what that stuff is. You just have this notion that there's a real world beyond your sensations, which exists independently of your mind. But you can't really qualify what that is, or the relationship that it bears to your sensations is somewhat mysterious. And when you try to qualify, like, what is matter, all you end up with is, you know, pictures and models and mathematical equations, I suppose, today, right? You know, what does it mean to say that matter is just strings vibrating in 11-dimensional hyperspace? And you talk to like a physicist like Brian Green or somebody, or one of the Michio Kaku, and you say, well, explain to me what matter is. And he'd say, well, the current theory is that strings vibrate in 11-dimensional hyperspace. And then what do they give you? He gives you a bunch of metaphors and equations and mathematical models and some sort of word pictures, like the idea of a string vibrating at a certain frequency. Well, that's, you know, it's just more sensations, or it's equations, but does it really explain to you what matter is? So that's I think the problems that Berkeley is really hitting at, and these problems about what matter is and whether materialism and empiricism go together. And that's one of the big questions that Berkeley raises. If you're an empiricist, where does empiricism lead? And on Monday, we'll be seeing how Hume takes empiricism even farther than Berkeley and shows that minds and God got to go too. All there are ideas. So, and the notion of cause and effect is going to go too. So we'll be talking about Hume on Monday. And I have the forums up, so don't forget to post before Monday, 11:55 p.m., and I'll see you on Monday.